Okay, we're now ready to do questions 19 through 26 to the end of the test. Question 19, the government is considering imposing a tax on the market for squidges and asks you whether the buyers or sellers are going to pay a larger share of the burden of this new tax. Here is the only data you have. If the price of squidges rises 10%, the quantity supplied rises 10%, and quantity demanded falls 20%. Choose the most complete answer. Well, first, you have to remember from our chapter on elasticity and our discussion of elasticity in lecture, the formulas for the computing the elasticity of demand when you have the results of an experiment. And basically, you have the percent change in the causal variable, in the affected variable, divided by the percent change in the causal. And in this case, the affected variable is always the quantity. In the elasticity of supply, the affected variable is going up 10%, and the causal variable is the price, and the price is rising 10%. So you have plus 10 over plus 10 equals 1. So the elasticity of supply equals 1. Now, elasticity of demand, we have the price change is plus 10, so the plus 10 is the denominator, and the affected variable is quantity demanded, and that falls 20%, so we have minus 20 over plus 10 equals minus 2, so the elasticity of demand is minus 2. All right, so there we have our elasticities. Now the next thing you need to know, or need to remember, is the formula for computing the burden of a tax, for computing who bears what fraction of the total burden of a tax. And that formula is, as stated in lecture, is the buyer's burden equals the elasticity of supply divided by the elasticity of supply minus the elasticity of demand. You have a minus sign for elasticity of demand because elasticity of demand is a minus number. And so the minus sign converts it into a positive number. In the book, the formula is elasticity of supply divided by elasticity of supply plus elasticity of demand, because in the book he always puts elasticities of demand, he always expresses them as positive numbers, even though technically they're negative numbers. Well, when you take these elasticities and plug them into those formulas, the elasticity of supply is 1, the buyer's burden equals 1 divided by 1 minus a minus 2, or 1 plus 2. So the buyer's burden is 1 divided by 3, 1/3. So of the total burden, the buyers are going to have 1/3 of the burden. So how much will the seller's burden be? And the answer is the seller's burden will be all the rest, or 2/3 of the burden. All right, now let's go ahead and look at the possible answers. One answer, since we have not been told who will be paying the tax, we cannot say who will bear the burden. Who will be paying the tax, I guess, means who will be sending the money in. But we have learned, if I emphasize, said it once, I said it 10 times, who sends in the money does not affect the burden of a tax. And so that statement is just wrong. Another answer possibility, there will be no burden of this tax since neither supply nor demand are elastic. Well, that's incorrect. If you know, I just gave you the formula, and the formula will get you a number, even if all the elasticities are inelastic. It doesn't matter whether they're elastic or inelastic. Another possibility, then buyers and sellers will share the burden equally. Well, no, not with these specific numbers. The buyer and seller will only share the burdens equally if their elasticities are equal. If the elasticity of supply and the elasticity of demand are equal except for sign, then the burden will be shared equally. For example, if you had elasticity of supply equals 4 and elasticity of demand equals minus 4, then the buyer's burden would be 4 divided by 4 minus a minus 4. Or 4 divided by 8, or 0.5, the buyer's burden would be 0.5. The seller's burden would be 1 minus 0.5 equals 0.5. They would be sharing it equally. That's not the case when the elasticity of supply and demand are unequal. And then one possibility is the buyers will bear more of the burden than the sellers. Well, wait. The buyer's burden is one-third, the seller's burden is two-thirds, so that's backwards. So the correct answer is, then sellers will bear more of the burden than buyers. Question 20. Evaluate each of the following statements having to do with the international foreign exchange markets, then select the best answer from the lettered choices below. Statement 1. Without the foreign exchange markets, by which citizens all over the world acquire the foreign money they need for purchases of the goods of foreign nations, international trade would not be possible. Well, I know that you want to believe that, except if you attended my lectures on international economics and have the handout, you would know that the foreign exchange markets are not necessary in order to have international trade. And so it is not true that there would be no trade if there were no foreign exchange markets. That statement is false. In fact, all of the examples that we had as we developed our model for international trade with the trade currency conversion ratios and the goods going in the two directions, all of those models involved had transactions in which currencies were never traded with each other. Always it was goods being traded for money, but never one kind of money being traded for another kind of money. So that statement is just wrong. Statement 2, the exchange rates in the international foreign exchange markets tend to equal the trade currency ratios of the internationally traded goods, but can deviate from those ratios for extended periods of time. That is correct. The foreign exchange market, as I just told you, does not exist in order for international trade to be possible, but it exists in order for specialization in international trade to be possible, so that the exporters, the experts in trading, moving goods from one country to another, don't have to also know all of the specialized information for moving some other good in the other direction. And the exchange rate therefore settles at some ratio which makes it profitable for trade to go in both directions. And if that exchange rate gets out of line, then it becomes very profitable to move all goods or a large number of goods in one direction and use the foreign exchange market to convert your currency back. But the problem is that it might take many weeks or months to set up the trades of the goods which are going to be going in one direction, in order to take advantage of the foreign exchange market, which will let you move the currency back or convert back. So it may be many weeks or months before the trades even begin to rectify an imbalance or an incorrect level of the foreign exchange market. And once trade begins, trade also has to build up until it's important enough so that it affects the prices. So it takes it can take a very long period of time. So statement two is correct. And therefore, the answer is, for question 20, only statement two is true. Now question 21. You look at figure X, and the what will, and then there are seven statements about this monopolist. The first three have to do with how much the monopolist is going to produce. Will it produce at F, at G, or at H? In chapters 9 and 10 on the theory of the firm, when you're calculating how much a firm produces, you always find the point where the marginal cost curve crosses the marginal revenue curve. And in the long run, you find the point where the long run marginal cost curve crosses the long run, the marginal revenue curve. And so you can look at figure X and you can see that that point where those two curves cross is just above output level G. So the correct output level is G. That means that statement 2 is correct, 1 and 3 are incorrect. Now, so the firm is going to set itself up in the long run to produce output level G, and that will mean that all the curves, the short-run curves, which are relevant at that output level, all of those curves are the ones which that firm would use. Now, first, you know that if that firm has been set up at output level G, then the short-run average cost curves come down and touch the long-run average cost curve, or tangent to the long-run average cost curve, at output level G. That is true for the curve which is labeled little c. So little c is the short-run average cost curve. That means that statement 5 is correct, and statements 4 and 6 are incorrect. And then finally statement 7 says that the firm will keep operating in the long run. Well, in the long run, a firm will keep operating if it is earning a profit, an economic profit, or at least breaking even. And this firm is clearly making an economic profit because its long run average cost is lower than its demand curve. And you remember, one of the things we learned about the demand curve is that the demand curve is the average revenue curve. So the way this the diagram is set up, average revenue is higher than average cost at output level G. So this firm should keep operating in the long run. Therefore, the correct statements are 2, 5, and 7. So the correct answer is only statements 2, 5, and 7 are correct. Next, question 22. Decide if each of the following statements is definitely true or definitely false, and then choose the best answer from A through E. Statement 1. As the level of an activity rises, the marginal cost curves tend to rise at first, then fall. No, that's wrong. When I drew the marginal cost curve for the theory of the firm for chapters 9 and 10, you'll remember the first curve I drew was the long-run marginal cost curve. It starts at the vertical axis, it goes downward, it then levels off and goes and is level for a long period of time and then starts upward. The downward sloping portion occurs because of huge gains from specialization and the division of labor. The firm is taking advantage of increasing returns to scale. That's at the lower outputs when the curve is falling. At the higher outputs, where the curve is rising, what's happening is the firm is experiencing diseconomies of scale. So statement one is incorrect. Statement two, if demand in the market increases for some reason, this does not mean that supply must increase also. Now this is a sort of a dirty trick statement, but this is intended to remind you of the difference between demand and quantity demanded. If demand increases for some reason, this means that the demand curve shifts. If the demand curve shifts, does this mean that that supply must increase also? An increase in supply is a shift in the supply curve. So when you translate this statement too, it says that if the demand curve shifts for some reason, this does not mean that the supply curve must shift also. Well, that's correct. Those two are independent. They have different causal variables. Shifts of demand are different from shifters of supply curves. Statement three, money makes it possible to avoid barter because money can act as a medium of exchange and a store of value. Yes, that's correct. I made a great play of that in the when we were doing the big picture model early in the class. Barter is very costly method of allocating or trading goods between people. So, money makes it possible to avoid barter. True. Statement four, without the invention and use of money, society would produce about 50% less output. Well, that's crazy. We would produce one-tenth as much output. I mean, it would be a catastrophe if we were, if we did not have money, if we had to organize and trade goods using barter instead of using some store of value. So that statement is clearly wrong. So the correct statements are, the correct statements are statements two and three. So that makes the correct answer. Statements two and three are the only ones which are true. Now question 23. Question 23, a firm can produce its product using the four resources listed in table X1 above. The marginal product of each resource and the price at which it can be purchased are listed for each resource. Choose the best answer. Well, this problem is intended to take advantage of the fact that any firm, a rational firm, is going to equalize the marginal product of a dollar spent on each resource in their budget. So if they've allocated their dollars in the most efficient way, it will be true that if they spend an extra dollar on electricians, they'll get the same result, the same benefit, output increase, marginal product, as they would by spending an extra dollar on accountants or an extra dollar on parts or whatever. So equalize those. Well, we also learned that the marginal product of a dollar spent on a resource is the marginal product of the resource divided by the price of the resource. It's the same as the marginal utility divided by the price for consumer theory. Same idea. Well, the table lists four resources, And resource 1, marginal product of 10, price of 2. 10 divided by 2 equals 5. Resource 2, 15 divided by 3 equals 5. Resource 3, 20 divided by 5 equals 4. And resource 4, 24 divided by 6 equals 4. So look, you have two ratios which are equal to 5 and two ratios which are equal to 4. That tells you that if you reallocate your dollars, you can increase your production without having more dollars. Pull dollars out of good resources 3 and 4. Reduce them in your budget. Use less of resources 3 and 4. Put the money into resources 1 and 2. When you pull a dollar out, you'll be losing 4 units. When you put the dollar into resources 1 or 2, you'll be increasing by 5 units. That gives you a free lunch. Okay? So the correct answer is that this firm should increase its budget for resources 1 and 2. Question 24. Suppose in country A they can produce an extra tractor by producing 2 less cars, while in country B they can produce an extra tractor by producing 4 less cars. Then which of the following statements is correct? Now, the easiest way of answering this problem is to remember the theory of everything, the theory of lowest opportunity cost. The firms will produce those goods, any individual or group will be engaged in the activity for which the opportunity cost is lowest, if the economy is operating efficiently. Well, in country A, if you produce an extra tractor, you give up 2 cars, so the opportunity cost of a tractor is 2. In country B, the opportunity cost of a tractor is 4 cars. You lose 4 cars. The opportunity cost of tractors is lower in country A, therefore country A should be engaging in the activity of producing tractors. Now, if you compute the opportunity cost of producing cars, it will be the other way around, so that country B will have the lower opportunity cost for producing cars. So country A should be exporting tractors. Country B should be exporting cars. But statement 1 says A should be exporting cars. That's wrong. Statement 2, the opportunity cost of producing cars is lower in country B than in country A. Yes, that's true. The opportunity cost of producing tractors is lower in country A, but the opportunity cost of producing cars is therefore higher in country B than in country A, lower in country B. Statement 2 is correct. Statement 3, the opportunity cost of producing tractors is lower in country A than in country B. That is correct. Statement 4, country B should sell cars to country A, and country A should sell tractors to country B. Yes, country A has the lowest opportunity cost of tractors, therefore should be producing the tractors. So statements 2, 3, and 4 are true, and number 1 is false. That's the correct answer. Question 25, labor-leisure choice diagrams. There are 9 diagrams shown. And then you may want to listen to the labor-leisure choice lectures. I have some of those up on my website if you want to review that, just in case a labor-leisure choice problem appears on the final exam. As discussed in lecture, in the U.S., from the early, we're supposed to evaluate 3 statements. As discussed in lecture, in the U.S., from early 1900s to the present, the average wage rate has increased substantially, and the average number of hours worked has decreased substantially. Figure 9 illustrates this. Well, Figure 9 does have one wage line which is steeper, illustrating that the average number of hours has, or the wage rate has increased. But in that Figure 9 diagram, the number of hours worked at the steeper wage is higher, is larger than the than it was at the lower wage. So that's backwards. So statement one is false. The second statement, figures 1 and 4, each illustrates the impact of an increase in non-wage income on a person. Of figures 1 and 4, both the wage line shifts upward parallel to itself. The non-wage income increases without any change in the wage rate. So that statement is correct. Statement 3, figure 7 illustrates a, quote, pure substitution effect, unquote, which is the impact of a change in price without any change in income. Income may be the a little bit misleading, but without any change in real income is what it was meant. In other words, you're not better off or worse off. The only thing that's happened is prices have changed, and so to maintain your level of happy welfare, you have to change what you buy and sell. And what you do is you switch to, you substitute goods for leisure or leisure for goods. That statement is correct. So the correct answer is only statements 2 and 3 are correct. And for that problem, you just need to review the lecture, the audio lectures that are up available on my website. You know the password to get to them. The audio lectures on labor leisure choice. Question 26. Refer to the above diagrams. Which one of these diagrams might illustrate a child whose allowance has been reduced while at the same time giving the child a higher hourly wage for doing chores around the house? The correct answer is figure 7. Figure 7. You can see that there is a steep line. The steep line hits the right vertical at a lower level, indicating lower non-wage income. This person has been given their monthly allowance has been reduced, but their hourly wage has been increased. And that is the end of this exam.